Transformation of America by Mark Phillips and Kathy O'Brien. Chapter 4, The Most Dangerous Game. When I learned of a pending rendezvous with Senator Byrd in Traverse City, Michigan, Vander Jagt's headquarters, I stole some candy at a local convenience market hoping to go to jail and escape my encounter with Byrd. I was caught, and the police were even called. But, of course, my poetically powerful abusers would not allow for me to have a police record. The entire matter was not so mysteriously and suddenly dropped. My only punishment was to have a conference with the school principal, Father Vespit. Father Vespit knew I was part of Project Monarch, and handled the matter accordingly. He raped me in the school's private chapel after school while holding a satanic ritual involving several of my project friends. Kids often attach nicknames to their teachers, and there were only a few of us who knew the reason why Father Vespit was called Father Fuzzbutt. His backside was covered with thick black hair. He counseled me on several occasions, once remarking, "I thought kids in your situation were all part of the exchange student program." My uncle Bob Tannis was visiting our house soon after that. He had flown in from what he claimed was a Black Ops Air Force intelligence operation. I know now that in typical CIA mode of operations, he was relating a story of lies salted with some truth. His point was to inform me that the Catholic Church is justified in its involvement with our government due to the priests hearing confessions from mobsters and spies. He also explained that exchange students were spies in the making, that priests found, through confession, were problems. Thus they were considered expendable and transferred out of the country. He then suggested to my father that I see the school guidance counselor, CIA operative Dennis Delaney, immediately. My father enthusiastically told me that Delaney was a longtime friend of his from Street Francis, who knew how to handle kids like me. Arrangements were made for me to see him after school. Delaney began by informing me that he was aware of everything, and that he knew just what I needed to put me back on track. He said that my family needed to take a trip to the Teton Mountains of Wyoming. He even provided maps and information in an envelope for my father. He turned off the lights in his office, and turned on a slide projector. He showed me scenes of the numerous waterfalls of the Tetons, all of which were to wash my brain of the reality that I was performing oral sex on him as ordered while the slides ran. Then he scheduled a follow-up appointment for further counseling. This trip to the Tetons would provide a change of scenery from the usual Mackinac/Niagara Falls trip, but I could no longer hope for a change in the direction life was leading me. I was told my life was predestined, and all I had to do was follow the road stretched out before me, that is the yellow brick road. I was destined for Wyoming, but would not know why until I arrived. I confirmed the family trip to the Tetons when I saw Delaney for my follow-up counseling. He informed me that he had already talked to my father about the trip, as well as our upcoming trip to Disney World in Florida. I was not surprised to learn of an additional trip. Nor did I have the capacity to become excited, suspicious, or apprehensive. I was aware that Delaney was heavily involved in Project Monarch, not only because he was accessing my sexual personalities again, but because he was helping to pave the way toward my destiny of total mind control. During Christmas vacation of 1974, my father flew us all to Disney World by route of Tampa, Florida. Ignorant of geography, it did not occur to me that Tampa was out of the way to Disney World until my father drove the rented van to the gates of MacDill Air Force Base. Military personnel met me there and escorted me into the base top-secret high-tech mind control conditioning facility for behavioral modification programming. This was the first in what became a routine series of mind control testing and / programming sessions on government installations that I would endure throughout my Project Monarch victimization. Whether I was in a military, NASA, or government building, The procedure for maintaining me under total mind control remained consistent with Project Monarch requirements. This included prior physical and/or psychological trauma, sleep, food, and water deprivation, high voltage electric shock, and hypnotic and/or harmonic programming of specific memory compartments/personalities. The high-tech equipment and methodisms I endured from that time on gave the U.S. government absolute control of my mind and life. I had been literally driven out of my conscious mind and existed only through my programmed subconscious. I lost my free will, ability to reason, and could not think to question anything that was happening to me. I could only do as I was told. After the MacDill Air Force Base experience, my home life worsened. The controls and conditioning that my father and mother executed on me tightened even more. I was no longer permitted to have any contact with my own brothers and sister. I only had one younger sister at the time. This stopped me in my subconscious efforts to protect them from my father's abuse, and left me with a desperate, empty aching for the loving relationships I previously shared with them. Of course, I never was able to protect them any more than I could defend myself or later protect my own daughter. However, until government programming began, I had routinely babysat them every evening and took them for long walks that lasted for hours in my feeble attempt to keep them out of my parents' range. Subconsciously, I believed I was making a difference. The day my youngest brother told my mother he much preferred my company over hers was the day I could no longer be near him or my other brothers and sister. Apparently, I was making enough of a difference that my parents were compelled to separate me from them. I was ordered to my closet-sized bedroom in the garage as soon as I got home from school or work. I could not speak to, look at, or hug my brothers and sister. I was not permitted to eat dinner with my family, although they let me out of my room to set the table, wash dishes, and do other chores. If I ventured from my bedroom to use the bathroom and was caught by my mother, she said, "Nobody rattled your cage," and ordered me back to my room in the garage. In the summer of 1975, my family drove all the way from Michigan to the Teton Mountains of Wyoming. I was ordered to ride in the back storage area of the family Chevy Suburban since I was forbidden to associate or communicate with my brothers and sister. So I dissociated into books, or into the metaphorical, hypnotic suggestions from my father and tranced deeper as I watched the prairie's seemingly endless sea of amber waves of grain streak past my window. Once when we stopped at a gas station, my father took me inside to show me a stuffed jackalope mounted on the wall. Due to my tranced, dissociative state and high suggestibility level, I believed it was indeed a cross between a jackrabbit and antelope. It was 100 plus degrees in the Badlands when it cooled down at night. The intense heat of the day accentuated my ever-increasing thirst. My father was physically preparing me through water deprivation for the intense tortures and programming I would endure in Wyoming. Dick Cheney, then White House Chief of Staff to President Ford, later Secretary of Defense to President George Bush, documented member of the Council on Foreign Relations, CFR, and presidential hopeful for 1996, was originally Wyoming's only congressman. Dick Cheney was the reason my family had traveled to Wyoming, where I endured yet another form of brutality, his version of a most dangerous game, or human hunting. It is my understanding now that a most dangerous game was devised to condition military personnel in survival and combat maneuvers. Yet it was used on me and other slaves known to me as a means of further conditioning the mind to the realization there was no place to hide, as well as traumatize the victim for ensuing programming. It was my experience over the years that a most dangerous game had numerous variations on the primary theme of being stripped naked and turned loose in the wilderness while being hunted by men and dogs. In reality, all wilderness areas were enclosed in secure military fencing, whereby it was only a matter of time until I was caught, repeatedly raped, and tortured. Dick Cheney had an apparent addiction to the thrill of the sport. He appeared obsessed with playing a most dangerous game as a means of traumatizing mind control victims, as well as to satisfy his own perverse sexual kinks. My introduction to the game occurred upon arrival at the hunting lodge near Grey Bar, Wyoming, and it physically and psychologically devastated me. I was sufficiently traumatized for Cheney's programming as I stood naked in his hunting lodge office after being hunted down and caught. Cheney was talking as he paced around me, "I could stuff you and mount you like a jackalop and call you it a leg deer. Or I could stuff you with this," he unzipped his pants to reveal his oversized penis, "right down your throat, and then mount you. Which do you prefer?" Blood and sweat became mixed with the dirt on my body and slid like mud down my legs and shoulder. I throbbed with exhaustion and pain as I stood unable to think to answer such a question. "Make up your mind," Cheney coaxed. Unable to speak, I remained silent. "You don't get a choice, anyway. I make up your mind for you. That's why you're here. For me to make you a mind, and make you mind slash mind. You lost your mind a long time ago. Now I am going to give you one. Just like the wizard, Avounds, gave Scarecrow a brain, the yellow brick road led you here to me. You've come such a long, long way for your brain, and I will give you one." The blood reached my shoes and caught my attention. Had I been further along in my programming, I perhaps would never have noticed such a thing or had the capability to think to wipe it away. But so far, I had only been to MacDill and Disney World for government/military programming. At last, when I could speak, I begged, "If you don't mind, can I please use your bathroom?" Cheney's face turned red with rage. He was on me in an instant, slamming my back into the wall with one arm across my chest and his hand on my throat, choking me while applying pressure to the carotid artery in my neck with his thumb. His eyes bulged and he spit as he growled, "If you don't mind me, I will kill you. I could kill you with my bare hands. You're not the first and you won't be the last. I'll kill you any time I goddamn well please." He flung me on the cot-type bed that was behind me. There he finished taking his rage out on me sexually. On the long trip back to Michigan, I lay in a heap behind the scats of the Suburban, nauseated and hurting from Cheney's brutality and high-voltage tortures, plus the whole Wyoming experience. My father stopped by the waterfalls flowing through the Tetons to wash my brain of the memory of Cheney. I could barely walk through the woods to the falls for the process as instructed, despite having learned my lessons well from Cheney on following orders. The next year when our annual trip to Disney World rolled around, my father drove, pulling his new Holiday Rambler Royale International trailer. I slept outside in a tent because I was not permitted inside it since I wasn't family. My father dropped me off en route at the Kennedy Space Center in Titusville, Florida, where I was subjected to my first NASA programming. From then on, I was obsessed with following the yellow brick road to Nashville, Tennessee. Moving to Nashville was all I could talk about. If anyone asked me the question I could not think to ask myself, why? I would respond by reiterating it was something I had to do. I had gone through the motions of my senior year in a dissociative trance. I became further distanced from religious values by my religion class teacher, Brother Emmett. This was due to his promotion of cannibalism via Pierre Paul Reed's book Alive, and by his teachings at a religious causal retreat I attended that included a cult ritual at St. Francis Church. I graduated from Muskegon Catholic Central High School in our bicentennial year of 1976. I was led by Senator Byrd to revise my plan to attend Hope College like I had promised Vanderjagt as a child. This new plan was for me to temporarily attend Muskegon Community College, because my real education was to come through mind control programming, not school. In order to be exhausted, as was necessary for my real education, I worked three menial jobs in addition to attending college. During my first semester of college in 1976, I made plans to take a trip to Nashville with my Project Monarch friend from Catholic Central. She remains an expendable victim to date, and therefore her identity must be protected from public release for her safety. My father explained that I was to stay at the Fiddler's Inn in Nashville, see the world-famous Printer's Alley row of sleazy country music nightclubs, and attend the Grand Ole Opry on Friday night, as ticket arrangements had been made through a friend, in spite of their scarcity during the Thanksgiving holiday. I never thought to associate Fiddler's Inn with Senator Byrd's fiddle playing when my friend and I arrived in Music City, USA. Nor did I find it odd when a country music star entertaining at the Black Poodle nightclub in Printer's Alley began directing my activities. My friend and I were provided with free passes to the Black Poodle to encourage us to return each night where entertainer and CIA operative Jack Green and his Desperado band were playing. During breaks between sets, Green and his band would sit with my friend and me to manipulate our suggestible minds. I was told it was my destiny to have met band member Wayne Cox, who had been trained for paramilitary mercenary operations under Louisiana's U.S. Senator J. Bennett Johnston. I soon learned that everyone associated with Green was involved in his CIA Freedom Train operations. When I told Green that my friend and I would not be returning on Friday night due to attending the Grand Ole Opry, he told us that he would be working the Opry that night. He made arrangements for us to come backstage and see him immediately following his segment. He explained that the security guard at the Opry, Nashville Metro Police Lieutenant Bob Ezell, was a good friend of his and would let us in. At the Opry, my friend and I sat in the audience watching as Jack Green introduced his special guest, U.S. Senator Robert C. Byrd. At the sight of Byrd, I went into a preconditioned deep trance and robotically went through the motions of following Green's instructions. Once backstage, Green pointed out his dressing room, which he was sharing with Senator Byrd, and ordered me in. The personality that had been sitting in the audience had perceived Byrd as an entertainer and could not, or would not, think further. But as I walked into the dressing room and saw Byrd perched on the edge of the mirrored vanity in his boxer shorts, I switched into the child personality that had known him as a U.S. Senator on Mackinac Island since age 13, and responded sexually. Afterward, Byrd was claiming me as his, excitedly telling me that he had always wanted his own little witch. I soon learned the enormity of this statement. Jack Green's band member, Wayne Cox, later told me that playing music behind Senator Byrd at the Opry was not the only way he backed him. He also backed him politically and in Freedom Train operations. Cox then made arrangements for my friend and me to stay the remainder of our trip at his trailer in Hendersonville, Tennessee. There was no choice but to comply. The following night, after Jack Green completed his show at the Black Poodle, he drove my friend and me to a nearby participating after-hours club, the Demon's Den. There, Cox was to pick us up and take us to Hendersonville. Instead, we were slipped a drug and taken on a tour of Union Station, Nashville's then abandoned train station, where supposedly the only train still running through there was the Freedom Train. Senator Byrd's attempted cultivation of superstition through my Catholic schooling should have maximized the impact of the occult ritual I was subjected to in the Tower of the Old Stone and Slate turn-of-the-century train depot. But the pain and horror was sufficiently effective in itself even without my adhering to superstition to produce the intended mind-shattering results. Cox took my friend and me on a flashlight tour through the rubble of Union Station, until we came to a homeless man sleeping on the ground. Cox ordered me to kiss the railroad bum goodbye, then shot him between the eyes while I was still only inches away. He then used a machete to chop off the man's hands, which he put in a Ziploc bag. He then led us up the rickety stairs into the lower of the old depot. The Jack Green, his band members, and others dressed in black robes were gathered around a black leather altar in a room lit by candles and draped in red velvet. In total shock, I was laid on the altar and subjected to rape and torture while the participants indulged in sex, blood, and cannibalism ritual. The next day I woke up on Cox's couch, vaguely aware that I had suffered a bad nightmare. When I stood up, I passed out from blood loss. I was bleeding profusely from the vagina. It was all I could do to prepare to drive back to Michigan, and my friend was certainly not in a stable frame of mind to help. I did not know what happened to me, nor was I able to question it. I had a new obsession on my mind. I had been programmed at the ritual to move to Nashville and marry Cox, as ordered by Senator Byrd. Back in Michigan, I made the announcement to my parents that I was moving to Nashville to marry Cox, as it was predestination. What they would not tell me was that my father had just literally sold me to Senator Byrd in exchange for lucrative military contracts that made him a millionaire overnight, a millionaire on a sixth grade education, a perverse, child-exploiting criminal, immune from prosecution, working as a CIA operative for the U.S. government. That mind-shattering occult ritual I endured in Nashville marked a new life of wealth and prestige for my father, white thrusting me into a new phase of my torturous existence, and I had no choice in any of it. 1. Nashville Metropolitan Police Lieutenant Bob Ezell, who also acted in the capacity of Grand Ole Opry Security Guard, covered up the murder,